You're listening to the New Yorker Poetry Podcast. I'm Kevin Young, poetry editor of the New Yorker magazine. On this program, we invite a poet to select a poem from the New Yorker archive to read and discuss. Then they read a poem of their own that's been published in the magazine. My guest today is Kate Baer, the New York Times bestselling author of three poetry collections, including most recently, And Yet. Kate, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. This is an honor, and I'm so excited to talk to you.
Now, the first poem you've chosen to read is The Morning After by Ellen Bass. What was it about this particular poem that caught your eye while you were looking through our archives?
The intimacy of it, I think, is what got me right away. You know, it's this narration of a woman that could be any woman getting up in the morning and seeing their partner and kind of going through maybe what to us is like a blip in the day, but when you stop, she really stops and kind of measures it. And I loved it right away. I'd read it before, but when I read it again, I thought, oh, I have to talk about this one.
Well, great. Why don't we listen to the poem? This is Kate Baer reading The Morning After by Ellen Bass.
The morning after. You stand at the counter, pouring boiling water over the French roast, oily perfume rising in smoke. And when I enter, you don't look up. You're hurrying to pack your lunch, snapping the lids on the little plastic boxes while you call your mother to tell her you'll take her to the doctor. I can't see a trace of the little slice of heaven we slipped into last night. A silk kimono floating satin ponds and copper koi, stars falling to the water. Didn't we shoulder our way through the cleft in the rock of the everyday and tear up the grass in the pasture of pleasure? If the soul isn't a separate vessel we carry from form to form, but more like Aristotle's breath of life, the work of the body that keeps it whole, then last night, darling, our souls were busy. But this morning, it's like you're wearing a bad wig, disguised so I won't recognize you, or maybe so you won't know yourself, as that animal burned down to pure desire. I don't know how you do it. I want to throw myself onto the kitchen tile and bare my throat. I want to slick back my hair and tap dance up the wall. I want to do it all over again, dive back into that brawl, that raw and radiant free-for-all. But you are scribbling a shopping list because the kids are coming for the weekend and you're going to make your special crab cakes that have ruined me for all other crab cakes forever.
That was The Morning After by Ellen Bass, which was published in the July 22nd, 2013 issue of The New Yorker. I'm glad you picked that poem too, because I think it really does get at the rock of the everyday, or as she says, the cleft in the rock of the everyday, and tear up the grass in the pasture of pleasure. What a great phrase.
So good.
And about then, maybe a little before, you start to hear those sounds, those R sounds, the pleasure, the shoulder. And then it sort of switches into these L sounds, the soul, if the soul isn't a separate vessel. And then at the end, that place, it almost trips you up. I want to do it all over again, dive into that brawl. And I'm wondering about that sonic pleasures of the poem as well as the kind of pleasures it describes. How do you map those two?
Well, in general, you know, her poetry speaks so much of pleasure. And I love that repetition all over again, even though I did trip up reading it.
I mean,
she just has such a way of doing it.
I mean, you're meant to, right? You're meant to hit this. Oh, right. It's a lot of all. It's like, no, really all.
Yeah, yeah. Gosh, I think it's probably so miserable to be married to a poet. She's like, be sexy, be romantic, stop putting me in this boring world and let's go down to the wild one. And I just loved that for that reason. I've had that same thought in the morning, like, oh, now we're just back to this every day. It's a brilliant little quick thought that she pauses on.
Yeah, and I love that it's sort of the you is the beloved, and whoever the you is, the beloved is also the everyday beloved. It's not like, you know, a fling or something. It's the power of a long relationship, and maybe even a late in life one. The kids are returning for the weekend, and your special crab cakes, which are different than.
Oh, I love that line. That's the best line One of my favorite things about poetry are the last lines. And this poem has a great last line. Your special crab cakes that have ruined me for all the other crab cakes forever. It's so good. She 'cause she returns to that love.
Well, and I wonder about that idea of ruin because there's something in there to me that the rest of the poem is kind of interested in. It's interested in the wreck, I almost want to think of it as not just the cleft in the rock, but the sort of wreck in that, the kind of breaking through in the everyday. And there's that kind of mystical feeling of the soul in the poem. I wonder about those things. Last night, darling, there's a humor too. Last night, darling, our souls were busy. That's a hilarious line. But then followed by this morning, it's like you're wearing a bad wig. I mean, I don't know if I would dare to put those two things juxtaposed next to each other. How do you take that kind of Aristotle meets bad wig?
Honestly, the first thing I thought of is the tension of what Gen Z calls the ick, which is like when your partner trims their toenails or is slurping their cereal, or in this case, they're just going through the motions of like the grocery store, which is so separate from the night before. She's saying in a very poetic way, but we all have that feeling sometimes about people we love. It's like, I love you, but you're also. This is also kind of icky, just because it's icky to be a human, and she describes that so well.
Do you think she feels ick? Because I almost feel like she likes the ick. If we're gonna stick with the
I think she likes it, but I think she likes pointing it out.
But there's this other part that happens, after the wig. But this morning it's like you're wearing a bad wig, which seems like an insult, disguise so I won't recognize you, or then it's, or maybe so you won't know
Maybe.
yourself. As that animal burned down. And there's that kind of knowledge, which I think is, a kind of, it's a kind of joke on carnal knowledge, but also a kind of knowledge of self. The speaker knows the self of the beloved in these unguarded, let's say, moments. And then I don't know, break, how you do it. I want to throw myself, break, onto the kitchen tile and bare my throat. I mean, that's really amazing as a kind of surrender to this animal nature that isn't there right now, at least in the poem.
She almost respects it. Like, I don't know how you do it, that you can separate yourself. She's not condemning it. She's just drawing a light to it and saying, I couldn't do it myself. but how amazing that you can.
The poet can't get out of the poet's way or somehow.
This does feel like a poem for poets, which I don't know if it is, because it's hard for me to separate myself from that, but it does feel like that to me. Like, she's writing this for me. Like, I can't separate myself either. Can you believe some people can like this?
What about praise? I think there's a part of poetry. A big part that is about praise. I mean, there's another part that's about cursing and damnation and saying that's part of what one has to say. But here, I think there's a kind of, I think the best praise is not praise of some perfection, but praise of warts and all kind of thing. And I wonder about that, this idea that I think it also kind of is toying with of saying too much almost, of almost being, praising a perfection, but there's this kind of other thing that's dragging it down, and that's the kind of ruin I think I mean that the poem is just as interested because, it's I don't know how you do it, but there's also a kind of curiosity in the ruin of the day, it isn't a poem about last night, though it sort of is. But it's set in the morning after, talking about that feeling that I think is both far and close to it.
Yes, she absolutely is doing that. And the kids coming home for the weekend. There are some parts of this that are so sweet though, too. She's saying it's ruined, but she's also saying, I think she's saying this a lot of this tongue in cheek, and kind of with a smile on her face. And yes, there are praise poems and there are not praise poems. This definitely feels like a praise poem.
Right. But I don't know if everyone could get away with praising a bad wig, you know. I think that's what I one of the things that's great about Owen. I wonder too about the sort of everyday. How do you approach the everyday in your work, and how does this poem tell you something about that, I guess?
That's what I love about her specifically. And there are many, many people like that. Wanda Coleman, Sharon Olds, who write poetry about the everyday. You know, there's this idea sometimes in the literary community that like there are things that are inherently not literary, like motherhood, like parenthood, fatherhood, marriage, relationships that are kind of a niche topic when they're actually so intertwined in most of our lives. And that's what I love about this poem and poems like this. It's that praise for the everyday that we're all experiencing and not taking everything so seriously. It draws me to it.
Yeah. Well, and I think because she does it so well, there's a temptation to overlook the sounds, which you mentioned briefly, but I think deserve calling attention to again. I mean, I sometimes look at the last words of a line and almost see the kind of poem that it creates, whether it's water and mother and doctor and pleasure and these kind of rhymes that she's creating, slant as they may be. And then there's things that are a little bit out of the way that I think make the surprise. I don't know how you do it, but those breaks, or I want to throw myself in, you know, like those breaks that happen toward the end of the poem or the late part, really change into this, you know, some of the change that you see there, that animal self, the wanting to slick back my hair and tap dance up the wall is sonic. You know, there's a kind of interruption, a kind of throwing over, enjambment, as we say, that turning of the line literally means throwing a leg over. And there's a kind of literally throwing oneself in the poem. And there's that quality that I think is really subtle. And that's someone like, I think, Sharon Olds or Lucille Clifton, one of my personal favorites, always has this surface that can seem very simple, but really is complicated and metric and musical and all these other things.
Yes, she writes by ear. Which I do too, and you can tell that it's very lyrical, that raw and radiant. There's so many parts of the poem like that that are very musical. It's beautiful.
Well, and the other thing is, you couldn't write a, I mean, it'd be really strange, though I think an interesting tension to have it be more formal, but yet there's this form, it's about the form of things being not the things themselves in a way, and that how the daily rhyming that we do is quite different than the nighttime rhyming in this case, or the sort of behind the scenes. And there's something about that, the public and the private, that I think the poem is really interested in.
Absolutely.
What about philosophy in poems? I feel like you're able to turn and, you know, say big things in poems, which are hard to do. I mean, you know, and I think this does it too. If the soul isn't a separate vessel. I mean, I love that moment. You know, you're here. You know, by then she could say anything. How do you take those sort of turns in the poem?
I don't know many poets who are not constantly dealing with an existential crisis. I feel like I just wrote my whole last book in an existential crisis. Is there a God? Why are we here? Why do we form these religious groups? What's going on? Especially in the wake of maybe the last few years, but since the beginning of time. My goodness, poets have been waxing poetic on existential crisis forever. And she, like Aristotle's Breath of Life, she's constantly bringing it back, kind of to that feeling of what are we doing here? And she does that, and she's doing so much in this poem.
Well, and I think the last thing I want to is the ending, which we talked about a little bit, but I think the way it works, like if you had told me in general, like you can end a poem with forever, I'd be like, I'm not sure. But here it's not a vague forever, like it was the forevers that I wrote like when I was a teenager, you know. You're like 15 and you think you know what forever is. But here It's actually forever. It's like for the end of time, crab cakes have been ruined for the speaker. And I wonder about that. How, because it's an ending that's unexpected in its ordinariness, like using crab cakes twice as the end of times. We're talking about like forever and pleasure and vessels and breath of life and then crab cakes.
I know, yeah.
Of juxtaposition. How do you think about that in poems?
Oh, I love when writers drop in ordinary words into the middle of a lyrical poem. I love the use of forever, and I love the repetition of crab cakes. She's just very playful, and it feels like a very playful ending, which is my absolute favorite kind of poetry. It is poems that don't take themselves too seriously, and this is a great example of that.
Now, in our July 25th, 2022 issue, New Yorker published your poem, Mix Up, which you'll read for us in a moment. Did you want to say anything about the poem first? Anything listeners might need to know before they hear it?
I want you to think about Lindsay Lohan and Jamie Lee Curtis.
Okay, let's hear it. Here's Kim Bear reading her poem, Mix Up.
This is called Mix Up. In a cosmic mix-up, the wife switches bodies with her husband. Nothing like this has happened before, she cries as she pulls on his pants, minds the crotch, barrels down the long staircase to an office where they call her Bud, and how about those Steelers? It's upsetting, the whole charade, except at lunch when she orders fries and no one says, "We're so bad," or at the meeting when she gives the room all her best ideas and they say, "Man, where have you been?" We have to fix this, her husband begs when the wife returns for dinner. Come here, she says, slipping off her shoes and drawing the curtains before she makes love to another life.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, POD15, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
I loved hearing that aloud, especially a line like, man, where have you been? Which has this double, suddenly it's man, a man. And you had mentioned Jamie Lee Curtis and Lindsay Lohan, of course. You were slow playing it so much that I was like, oh, wait, I had to go back.
I just love that switching bodies trope, which is where this poem began.
What I love is the title. I don't know, like the perspective of it too. I mean, another poet would have said like but like by making it kind of a fable, I almost think of it as doing something different than The Morning After, which thinks about the everyday as mythical, or the ways we break into the mythical or the soulful. And here it's sort of like I'm using myth to illustrate the everyday. And I wonder about that. How that did it come to you, or you were always thinking about it, or how did it sort of come about?
I was thinking about literally switching bodies with my own partner, and I just, like I said, I've always loved that trope in storytelling. I think because those kind of tropes, they're an emotional shortcut, which we need in poetry to get to the heart of the story. And this is in this instance, it's the difference between being a man and a woman in the workplace, which I think a lot of people can resonate with. But that kind of, trick kind of gets you to it quicker. And yeah, this poem is very different than Ellen's. They're both about relationships, but you're right, it's in a different way.
Well, I'm interested too, then, this tone you have. It's upsetting the whole charade, a great line, except at lunch, because there's a way in which the upset, you know, who it's upsetting for who there, you know, it's told almost kind of objectively. And you realize she's slowly starting to realize some of the benefits for her. Except at lunch when she orders fries and no one says we're so bad. I mean, that isn't just about the workplace, right?
Not just about the workplace. I think about this, I mean, all the time, but especially when it comes to food, how women together eat much differently than men do together. Men just like kind of hog it up as much as they want, which women want to do too. But we have to go through this song and dance of we're so bad and I shouldn't do this and let's just split this and I'm just going to have a salad. I'm not that hungry. And it becomes this whole performance that would so quickly be erased in a mix-up. And I think that would be one of the first things you would notice, just a guess, is the restaurant and the food arena.
Sure. Well, in this meeting, which I've been in that meeting, you know, where someone says something and then another person says it, you know, maybe that person's a man and they suddenly, it's like it was first spoken ever, you know, and I think that that kind of reality in a poem, we would take very differently if it wasn't in this fable. Is this a technique you've turned to before or after?
I don't think so. This is the first poem like this I think I've done. There's another one in my first book where it talks about a woman who, right before her wedding, I don't know why I'm saying a woman, this is a true story. A friend's dad said, you know, don't get fat like other wives do. And then I brined him in a deep salt bath. And I kind of go through how I would cook up this man and eat him to show him how hungry I am. So I guess that's kind of like this, kind of making the real life.
I love that poem. Well, tell me about the end of Mix Up and this sort of, is it a seduction? Is it, you know, what happens in that second stanza for you? This, the husband, we have to fix this, which I love that sort of gap between man, where have you been? And we have to fix this.
Yeah, I wanted to have kind of a delicious ending to that, because how many times have, as a woman, kind of been dismissed after saying, no, this is so unfair, I don't want to do this. And like, oh, calm down, it's okay. Here's kind of an antidote. That antidote is particularly funny to me. I wanted it to be kind of a delicious moment at the end, which I hope I achieve there.
And it might be a good chance to talk real briefly about that first book, which did so well and really resonated with people. Was that something you expected, or how did that happen for you? How did you experience that?
That book came out November 8th of 2020. I don't know if you remember what was going on that day, but it was a very contentious day in history. And also we were in the middle of COVID. So I thought no one would read this. I thought the news cycle is so distracted. And so I was shocked for it to even make it on the list. I didn't even know how that list worked. So I was really blown away. Yeah, people wanted poetry, I think. I think it's very funny when people write in articles or say poetry is really having a moment, because, you know, poetry's had a lot of moments over history. So it's not just now. But I do think there was that time in our most recent history, people were ready for something, a book like that. And so that's my best guess. But it was a huge shock. Yeah.
And then after that, the success of that first book, you published a great book about some of the letters you got from that first book.
Yeah, I did not intend to write a whole book of erasure poetry. I was really doing that as a party trick on the internet. My publisher really kept pushing it. I think you should write a whole book of these. And I thought, well, that's going to be such a downer. But yeah, it also really connected with people, which I'm so glad. It was kind of a nightmare to write. I had to write it in my van. It was COVID, and I couldn't work in my house, and I couldn't work in any coffee shops because, you know, you couldn't go inside. So I would take my computer, my laptop, and prop it up on my steering wheel and borrow the internet from coffee shops to write. So yes, that came out after, a year after, which was a mixed bag to write, but had a good reception, and I'm glad people connected with it.
So the first one's What Kind of Woman? And then I hope this finds you well. I mean, what I was struck by seeing those, I think I saw them in real time before they were in a book, was just how, I don't know, because it captures both how people feel really emboldened in this moment to write to people they don't know and say really crazy, personal, even, you know, offensive things. And then also how funny you've made their very words, or rather, another way to put it, how within them is lurking something else that they don't even know.
Sure.
Was that some of what struck you? I mean, it must have been, hey, you're getting all this fan mail, of course, but then you're getting some of these strange, some are emails, I guess. When in that process did you decide you were going to start doing that? You said you just did that almost as a parlor trick, but...
Yeah, I mean, the first time I did it was right after George Floyd was murdered, which, again, was another contentious time. So everyone was kind of arguing about police reform. And this woman came into my DMs, like happens on the internet. I'd like to mention, you know, we're in the Wild West of the internet. This is not that new. We have very little regulation. Anyone can be anyone and message anyone and say anything. And so really trying to figure this out. Anyway, so this woman messaged me, and just on a whim, I took a screenshot and hid her identity, because I kind of saw the words like pop out in a new way. And I thought, you know, oh, I'll make a poem out of this. And because so many people connected with it, yeah, like a party trick, I kept doing that. But then I kept seeing things everywhere. I'd be looking at my kids' vocab sheets and the sentences they would use. And I would, oh, I could make a poem out of this. And it just kind of snowballed into something else, not just messages to me. You know, I used Brett Kavanaugh, a transcript, some lines from Donald Trump, you know, a bunch of different things I use to make poems. But yeah, very unexpected. I like to say I'm in retirement from doing that. However, people continue to message me. And I like to just put a PSA out. If anyone is planning to message me some unkind things, please use nouns. Please use adjectives, because it's really frustrating to get those messages and not being able to use it now, you know?
Well, and I think it's, you know, we were talking about poetry having a moment. There's a weird way in which erasure is having a moment. I mean, I've seen some really powerful erasures. You know, I happen to be able to name a few Black poets who've done that, Tracy K. Smith or Robin Cost Lewis. I know Nicole Seeley's doing things like that. You know, I'm curious about how you, the politics, I guess, of erasure. And you're mentioning George Floyd. It seems like that was part of what you were thinking about, at least.
Initially, in that first message, I was thinking about that. You know, anything that I posted that was political, it was like, can you stop being so political? Which I also think is kind of funny to say to a poet. Poetry is so political.
But I wonder about erasure as a technique. Do you think of that as political? I guess is the question.
I guess it depends what you're erasing, or I guess it's political either way. It really depends what you're erasing, and if that person wants to be erased. There's certainly a lot of people that I've taken their messages that I'm sure do not appreciate that and are that feel very politically charged. Yeah, I do think it's political, although I think all poetry is political, so.
And what about you? What's next? What are you thinking about? You've been working at a quick clip. Is that how you work on books? You tend to work on book-length projects, or are you kind of poem by poem, and then you look back and suddenly you have a book? How do you approach that?
I am writing another book, although this has slowed down. Like I said, I didn't mean to do 3 books in 3 years. There was supposed to be a gap there, but that erasure poetry slipped in. So yeah, taking some time to kind of reevaluate my own existential crises and see what comes next. Very interested in screenwriting. Always have 10 novel ideas in my brain. I could have never predicted that I would have 3 poetry books in 3 years. So I could never make a guess what comes next, but I'm sure some poetry, I can't escape it. And I don't want to escape it.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to talk today.
Thank you, Kevin. It was an honor to be here.
Mix Up by Kate Baer, as well as Ellen Bass's The Morning After, can be found on NewYorker.com. Ellen Bass's most recent book is Indigo. Kate Baer's latest poetry collection is And Yet.
You may subscribe to this podcast, the Fiction Podcast, the Writer's Voice Podcast, and the Politics and More Podcast by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. You can hear more poetry read by the authors on newyorker.com and The New Yorker app, available from the App Store or from Google Play. The theme music is The Corner by Christian Scott Atunde Ajua, courtesy of Stretch Music and Rope-A-Dope. The New Yorker Poetry Podcast is produced by Michelle Moses, with help from Hannah Eisenman,